Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This is going to be a big summer for Los Angeles theater. There's going to be a meeting of one of the biggest nonprofit theater consortiums in America. There are going to be several festivals going on. Since we were all talking about theater around KCRW, I decided to invite John Stepling, who won this year's Playwriting Award and has been deeply involved with Los Angeles theater for the last 30 years. His newest play, which won the LA Weekly Award, is published in a new anthology called Fever Dream, which is coming out soon from the Padua Playwrights Press. And over these 30 years, he has been involved with most of Los Angeles' theater people. He's taught internationally, including at the Polish Film School, and he has taught playwriting. He's given a great deal of thought to theater as ritual, to what a theater space is, to what a theater company is composed of. He's directed and ran theater companies in Los Angeles over the years, and I've watched his work. We were friends 30 years ago. We're friends now. I acknowledge this. John, when you started, how did you know that you were a playwright rather than a poet or an essayist or a novelist?
Well, I actually started out originally wanting to be a musician or a painter, and then I wrote poetry. And it wasn't until I went to New York, and my cousin was there, Jim Storm, and he was doing a Sam Shepard play. This is 1971.
Sam Shepard, the Pulitzer Prize-winning American playwright, who was defining theater, really, at that time.
Well, this is what's interesting, is that I walked into the sort of final but still very vibrant stage of Off-Off-Broadway. And Sam and Murray Mednick and so forth were working out of Theater Genesis. But there was La Mama, Cafe Chino, you know, Judson's, a lot of places. And that off-off Broadway eruption of work was, in a certain sense, the last genuine movement in American theater, I think.
We're talking 40 years ago.
And we are.
Yes.
Yeah. To me, it was very exciting. And I suddenly was having my sense of what theater could be redefined. And I somehow felt I wanted to be part of this. Now, I didn't start working in theater till 10 years later when Murray came out here and started the Padua Festival. And he invited me to come out and do a play in spite of the fact I had written nothing. And there were a number of incredibly talented people. From Walter Hadler, Jean-Claude Van Attali, Ronnie Tavel, Shepard, Marie Irene Fornes, etc., working off-off-Broadway. And the problem, I think, for American theater, in a sense, today is that everything that has come after that has been linked to that energy, has been an aftershock from that original eruption. And in a sense, you know, this is the problem with big institutional theater now, is that I read something in The New Yorker recently, just to digress for a second, in which John Lahr was writing about John Guare, who was sort of part of Off-Off-Broadway. And he said something to the effect that Guare was the only writer to have the energy and cunning or something to climb out of Off-Off-Broadway and make it, presumably, to Broadway. This is a problem in perception, I think, culturally. And, you know, it's aided and abetted by critics, in a sense, because Off-Off-Broadway was not something you wanted to escape.
Yes, it seems to me also that they're working with an older model. On Broadway today, it's not the case that Broadway is the place you graduate to from the working ground. Broadway is a commercial space like an old-style department store where musicals and comedies are purveyed with actors who might otherwise be in movies, commercial movies, big money-making procedures. Off of Broadway was where you went if you were, pardon me, truly a writer, and your work would be produced on a shoestring and presented.
And presented. And it allowed all those writers that worked off Broadway were allowed to experiment, you know, and they worked very quickly. They put things up very quickly often. And it allowed them to grow as writers. And it's what big institutional theaters don't allow for anymore. The model you refer to, which is the basic one throughout the entire country, you know, is pretty much interested in developing plays and not playwrights. They're developing commodities. They need a hit play. And so everything is driven by the marketers and managers and so forth to that end. Now, I was gone for 10 years, and I came back 2 years ago to Los Angeles and kind of plugged back in and started to go to theater and see people and form a company and so forth. The problem is that the sense I get is, you know, if you had Sarah Kane, for example, who might be the best playwright since Pinter, you know, who was this one kind of blazing meteor across the theater sky and burned out, where would Sarah Kane go in the United States to get work done? You know, she submitted something to the Arena Stage or Public Theater in New York or the Taper or somewhere. I don't think it would be given much attention.
Okay, so speaking of Sarah Kane, who did burn out, she killed herself, yes?
Yes.
And the work was very radical, very disturbing, very upsetting. Mm. So is then theater to be produced by people who understand that what they're producing is not going to be pleasing to their audience, okay? Is pleasure a part of this procedure?
That's a really germane question. Peter Brook once said that all theatrical acts are self-destructive. I think artists in general, but let's stay in the realm of theater, have to have an argument with society. Wes Walker used that term with me recently, and I thought, yeah, that's right.
He's an L.A. playwright.
He's like very good L.A. writer. And the large institutional model, in a sense, is part of a system that young artists should have an argument with. But such is the exclusionary nature, I think, right now. And, you know, you are encouraged toward a certain aesthetic docility. And you are discouraged from having that argument or raising those questions.
I'm talking to John Stepling about the state of theater in the country and in Los Angeles. This is a big summer for theater in Los Angeles, or is it? Now, John, let's remember, you quote Peter Brook, whose really breakthrough works, like Marat Sade, were of tremendous interest to an American audience. We watched him go on to do a film of the Mahabharata. We watched his production of Midsummer Night's Dream when he put actors and actresses on tight ropes. And this was once he was the international theater director whose work we looked forward to, and it was at that time presented on Broadway. What happened? Why don't we see this?
Sadly, we don't. That's for certain. And I think this becomes a very big question, and the answers are quite far-reaching because it has to do with the society at large and a kind of kitsch sensibility that exists. I mean, we live in the 21st century where people have internalized so much narrative, so much cultural product through marketing and television and film that I think they experience everything as kitsch, even when it's not. But the idea is to maximize profit. And for whatever reason, the people that took over producing theater, tended to discourage radical work. Now, you know, I can hear people arguing, well, but this took place and that took place, and there's this, you know, avant-garde show at Red Cat or something. And Red Cat brings in a lot of interesting stuff here to Los Angeles. But more often than not, it's a kind of facsimile radical art. And you rarely can look at American theater artists and say, I can't wait to see the next thing that they do. Because they will be building upon what they've already done. And that somehow there's going to be a journey here that we get to share with them. I can think of almost none.
Now, you've started a theater company. It's called
Gunfighter Nation.
And you work with writers in a workshop situation on weekends.
Yeah.
These writers are brand new. They're coming from all kinds of communities around the city. They're of different ages, and they're doing work for the first time. They're not coming in, often as not, with advanced degrees. You're training them not only to be theater writers, but to think the way a writer does who's trying to do something unusual, different, perceptive.
Yeah. One of the things that I don't know, defines the Padua movement, if that's what it was.
This all began at Padua Hills in a playwriting festival that was directed by Murray Bednick, who's since become one of the foundations of theater in Los Angeles. He began in New York.
Right. And it was a text-driven theater. And it was not a director's theater. So there was a close reading, a close examination of text, and a close dissection of text. And I think that what you tend to get now is, unfortunately, theater is perceived as like the poor relation to film. And you get a lot of writing that is not interested in, you know, the elusive mysteries that exist in a ritual space like a stage. They are sort of plot-driven, or there's simply a montage of pictures and so forth. I've liked to say that when the lights come up on a stage, there is a sense that something has just fled the stage and that the rest of the play is in pursuit of that which has fled. And the climax, if there is one, such as it is always in good theater, in a sense, melancholy, because the play has realized that it won't capture that which has fled. I use these kinds of models and talk this way because I think there is a poetics to the theater space that is very important, that is intrinsic to it. And it's something that has been lost, I think, over the last 40 or 50 years on the American stage.
Well, what you're hearing is that John Stepling, the playwright who began and has returned to Los Angeles, is a sort of Svengali. That is to say, he believes in theater, and it's necessary in states of belief to transfix others, because you can't transmit knowledge. You can transmit enthusiasm and belief, and then once you've dazzled people who enjoy hearing you, you can inculcate information. You can transform things. Now, we're talking about something that has happened somehow. None of us can account for it, but it's happened in our arts in America. Just very recently, I became aware, others have known this for a while, that the playwright David Mamet, who lives here, has gone from considering himself an activist and a person with liberal values to considering himself a conservative and regards liberals as the enemy. And something did happen. we have very few radicals. What we have is liberals. And it could very well be that conservatives who have gone to war provide a better picture than liberals who are trying to ameliorate and compromise. It's a very difficult thing when we've lost the radical impulse. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's true. I mean, you know, the entire society, the entire Western world, I guess the entire planet is in a state of crisis. And there is a kind of denial about this. But, you know, the desperation out there is palpable. And somehow writers continue, unfortunately, I think, to be more concerned with career than with the work they do. And this goes back to my, you know, talking about having an argument with society. I look at groups. Poor Dog is a very good group out of CalArts. And, you know, they lack anger, as skilled as they are. And part of how this happened is that, you know, the major theaters are under enormous financial strain, enormous financial pressure. And they are looking for the next hit play, and they're going to round off the corners, and they don't want disruptive forces entering their institution. So they've effectively excluded them, really.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Stepling, a playwright whose play, Phantom Luck, is included in the new anthology, Fever Dreams, and will continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking to John Stepling, who has been involved in the formation of theater companies and in the observation of American theater from the perspective of Los Angeles. I would say that even when you've been working in Poland, you've kept an Angeleno perception in your work, which is an anti-Angeleno perception, that is, that the Los Angeles presented in Hollywood movies, the world as presented in commercial movies, is not the world we want and need to examine, to interrogate.
No, and, you know, I think a big part of this entire discussion leads us to the destruction of public education in this country. I said earlier, I fear often that audiences perceive whatever they see in kitsch terms. You know, the norms of banality and entertainment and the superficiality and cleverness and sentimentality and all of these things have become normative themes and tropes. And both the writers and the audience have internalized these. You know, when I would show students, I was teaching in a film school, when I would show them Bresson.
The great French director thought to be both minimalist and spiritual. My favorite film is probably his last, The Devil Probably. Yeah.
But I would usually show them either Pickpocket or something, and they would hate it. These were first-year students. Most of them, despite the fact this was a prestigious international film school, didn't know Bresson. But after 6 months of Bresson and Ozu and Bruno Demont and, you know, whoever, Antonioni, I would see them downloading Bresson on their laptop, and they would come and talk about The Devil Probably or Lancelot du Lac. And I thought, well, it just took them a while.
Well, you can't know something you haven't been taught. You see, people forget this. That what you teach in the school ends up with the end product of being what people know. And if they haven't been taught, if they've had a deficient education, then they end up not knowing very much.
Yeah.
And we're, as a teacher teaching young playwrights, I think that's where you begin, by rectifying, What do you do with a group of writers who come to you without knowing what the history of their art form is, what it can do?
Right. I think that, you know, this has become such a complicated question because we can talk about the transition from Romanticism to modernism to postmodernism. And, you know, the kind of eclipsing of almost everything by irony. And, you know, you have to sit down and talk about that stuff a little. And you have to talk about text in a serious way. And again, you know, this is why, in large measure, I blame big institutional theaters in this country for killing theater. It's boring.
Well, you know what I think, John, in addition, something even worse happened. That theater, the theater you're speaking of, the theater of the 60s, off Broadway, had a radical bent. There are now, instead of radical politics, there's theory. And theory is, if you'll pardon my way of phrasing it, a commodification of radical thought. That instead of what you call anger, there's dark, thoroughgoing intelligence which does nothing at all. People are informed without being active. In fact, the theory is often so difficult that it enforces sitting and reading and rereading and rereading and no responsive activity except the repetition of coming to have learned the theory.
Well, there's certainly a fetishizing at a certain level of learning, you know, a fetishizing of information and theory, and there's no question. But at the same time, you know, I think there is often these days just an absence of curiosity about the origins of things and a mythological base from which an art form like theater is inextricably bound. And I think that, you know, when I get students in the workshop I teach now, some are older, some are younger, some have some experience, some none, I try to, you know, it's almost a process of subtraction. I said, you know, there's such a preponderance, such a surplus of narrative, bad narrative out there, so many mechanisms of storytelling that have just been rendered trite, that often it's getting rid of stuff so that you can try to find something in there that has the sound of authenticity somehow.
John Stepling, my guest, is the author of Phantom Luck, which is one of the plays in the new anthology published by the Padua Playwrights Press. It's called Fever Dreams. And he is also the author of a collection of plays called Sea of Cortez and other plays. Tell me, how can someone interested in your workshop or in your theater company, Gunfighter Nation, find out more about it?
Well, you can come by the Lost Studio on La Brea, 130 South La Brea, on Saturdays and come talk to me. There's a Facebook page, I believe. I think it's still up. I'm not very good with that stuff. Or you can just Google John Stepling and you'll probably be taken to a page that is my web page. I don't actually have the address with me.
It's nice, though, to have someone begin by saying how to find you rather than how to find your page.
Well, come by the Lost Studio.
What time?
1 o'clock on
Saturdays.
And it's 130 South La Brea. And, you know, everyone is always welcome to come check out what we're doing.
Now, just so that we don't seem entirely like shut-ins or miscreants, are there things coming up during this summer's film festival, theater festival series that you're interested in pursuing yourself?
Well, I mean, I will certainly go see the Poor Dog piece that they base on a Gertrude
Brucey
Stein,
and Willie.
Brucey and Willie, on the Stein text, which I haven't seen and which I heard was very good. Some of it I don't know. But when a play is described in the first sentence as a romp, you know, dot, dot, dot. I recoil with kind of horror. You know, this is the problem, though. You know, is there anything in large theater that excites the imagination of people where you just desperately, I've got to get a ticket, I've got to go see it? I find very little. I mean, when Peter Brook comes to town, I'm excited. But there's very little else. And you know, it's a crisis in theater in this country.
Because I regard it as one of my jobs to ferret out what there is when there is something. I'm looking for it in the belief that it's buried there, hidden by deceitful ad copy.
I can tell you there are companies in Los Angeles. What Tina Cronus does at LACC, Sacred Fools, Zombie Joe's Underground Theater, Son of Semele, these are all people that should be supported. You know, they are all companies that are with some integrity trying to find their voice in all of this. And they're all worthy companies. They're just under the radar. I mean, in the same way that politically, you know, there's lies by exclusion from, you know, the mainstream news, mainstream critics tend to ignore certain companies, and McNulty will never go to Equity Wave or Theater. He will only go to the Mark Taper Forum or South Coast Rep or something. This is a very big problem. I mean, in the off-Broadway days, in the 60s and 70s, even into the beginning of the 80s, there was a very active kind of alternative press that cared about stuff and would make sure you heard about it. And they would go anywhere to find it. This is not the case anymore.
I've been talking with John Stepling, the playwright whose Phantom Luck is included in the anthology Fever Dreams. It's published by Padua Playwrights and won the LA Weekly Theater Award for Playwriting. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. You can share it with an enemy, too. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.